interviewed have Don Kors. Don is the author of the recently written published book, Government Pirates, The Assault on Private Property Rights and How We Can Fight It. He's also been a developer. We are Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And joining us on the Commons today, I'm really pleased, successful real estate developer for a number of years. He's a sought-after public speaker, and he has testified before Congress on property rights issues. Don, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure, it's good to be with you.
Don, tell me something. Why did you write the book? You must have had some reason to decide to do this.
Well, as you mentioned, I've been a developer. I've been a developer and businessman for over 25 years, and I have seen firsthand the reckless and irresponsible behavior of local, state, and federal government agencies. And in June of 2005, when the Kelo versus New London decision came down, I had followed that to a certain extent, but then when I went outside and picked up my morning newspaper and saw that it was a 5-4 decision allowing New London to transfer its powers of eminent domain to a private developer, I was frankly outraged because, over the years, I have seen all this behavior from local government, and to give local government that power to me was unconscionable. And that's what started the genesis of the book. But quite frankly, eminent domain is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to assaults on private property rights. The book Government Pirates delves into not only eminent domain abuse, but also zoning, wetlands, and endangered species protection abuses. And at least in eminent domain, theoretically, and I have to stress theoretically, you're supposed to be compensated for when your property is being bought by the government. But in zoning, wetlands, and endangered species issues, you not only do not get compensated in many cases, but you get extorted land or money in return for approvals. And this just isn't happening to developers. This is happening to everyday Americans, homeowners, small business owners, farmers, and ranchers throughout the country. And I felt that I needed to write this book to wake up the public because the mainstream media really hadn't caught on to this.
They're asleep someplace, aren't they?
They are asleep. And it just seems that I was trying to fill a void, and I believe I have. I've had a number of interviews throughout the country. I've been on a number of TV shows. And it seems that the media hasn't caught on to this issue, but this is one of those kitchen table issues that people talk about all the time. And the reason they talk about it is just maybe they're not directly affected by eminent domain or these other takings, but they know someone who is. But everybody is touched by the government when it comes to regulations. For example, someone who simply wants to put an addition on their home, they have to pay fees to the county to check their plans, inspection fees, and so forth. And here it is. It's your home. You want to add to it, and you have to pay the county these fees. And that's probably the least egregious sort of case, but that gets under people's skin. But if you look at these other takings, of course, they're much more egregious.
But if those aren't stopped, I know Fairfax County, what they will do is you have to go and buy a permit every time you replace something. So if your hot water heater dies, you've got to go and pay the county. It's not that they come and inspect it, which would be okay. You could make an argument for that, but you just have to pay them.
Well, they're experts at coming up with ways to provide fee income, and particularly when times are bad, the bureaucrats certainly don't want to be laid off. So I tend to think they have guys in little green shades back in the corner somewhere, just figuring out how they can come up with more fees to justify their bureaucratic existence. And you see it everywhere. It's just not in Fairfax County, but it's in every community throughout the country.
Yeah, I can only speak. I've done it in Fairfax County. I see it here, but I've heard about it in other counties as well, and I know the problems that exist. You talked a little bit about the Kelo case. We've discussed the Kelo case. We've had Suzette on a number of times, and we've talked about what happened, but would you like to give us, just to remind people who may not be up on the issues, exactly what the Kelo decision means and what it meant?
In June of 2005, the Supreme Court, in their infinite wisdom, decided that on a 5-4 vote, they agreed with the city of New London, Connecticut, to allow the city to transfer its powers of eminent domain, which is the ability of the government to purchase property for, quote, a public purpose. Those transferring those powers to a private nonprofit development group was something that was a little unusual. Usually, it's done by a redevelopment agency, which is composed of elected officials. But in this case, it was to a private development corporation. And that private development corporation then had the authority to seize homes and businesses of people, including Suzette Kelo and many others, was able to seize that property for the sake of building a luxury condo project, a hotel, and other commercial development. And it was a case that really sent shockwaves throughout the country, because right then and there, people understood, as a result of the polls, many of the polls were 90 to 95% of all Americans opposed seizing property for economic development, which is exactly the way it was couched. But for people to be under the cloak of the government to be able to seize this property, a lot of people just felt that they could be next. And unfortunately, it's happened to thousands, hundreds of thousands of people throughout the country.
So I think one of the problems with the Kelo case in Fort Trumbull is that there really was no plan on the table for Suzette's property. It was simply and sweetly because they didn't really want that pink little house there. It devalued what they were trying to do.
Well, you know, unfortunately, if you look at all the cases, the redevelopment schemes that have come up throughout the country, 9 times out of 10, there is no plan in place. Exactly. And Fort Trumbull was no different. What agencies do is, in order to entice a developer or a corporation or a lead tenant of a shopping center project, for example, they want to seize the property first, and then, you know, they sort of have the cart before the horse. They want to seize the property because then that's a better enticement for developers to come in. And I'm not saying that happens in all cases, but I would say I would be comfortable in saying 9 times out of 10. So the New London case was no different from many other cases throughout the country. And there's cases up in New York that I'm aware of, in the city of New York, that they have no idea of what they're going to do with the property. But they do know that they can put certain types of developments on there, but they don't have their financing in place. They don't know exactly what the cost is. And that's how they operate.
So they take property, they seize it, they put people out of their homes, and they bulldoze their houses for no reason at all? Is that what you're saying?
They're saying that there is a reason, that there is a development. In the Kelo case, let's use that as an example. Suzette Kelo's cottage, as well as the other homes, were taken.
Mm-hmm.
Those homes around hers, her house was transported somewhere in the city that's now a museum. But the other homes were all bulldozed, and now it sits, all that property sits as an open, barren field.
Right.
And reportedly, the city has spent $78 million. $78 million for a project that the developer pulled the plug on.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it? Well, Michael Cristofaro, who was one of the final holdouts, I think he was one of the last two.
Mm-hmm.
That was their second house that was seized by eminent domain, and the first one, the location where the first one sat is still vacant.
Yeah, that was it was near a retaining wall, if I recall correctly.
I don't know where
it
was. But when I talked to Suzette, I had her on the air, and I said, Suzette, describe your neighborhood. And in one word, she said Beirut. This was at the beginning, and that's what, you know, which surprised me because I'd seen pictures of Fort Trumbull. It looked like an, you know, idyllic New England type of town. So that's one way the government sort of goes out, gets crazy and takes away property. But you list a whole series of different kinds of abuses that the government is doing, zoning, wetlands, endangered species, and you've got stories about all of them.
Yeah, and, you know, the way I organized the book, the way I wrote it, I thought the least egregious was really the eminent domain issues, if you can believe that. And when you get into zoning, some of the arbitrary decisions that are being made by local government are just astounding. But then when you get into federal wetlands and federal endangered species protection, there's some stories that'll just horrify you that, you know, I've had people say on some endangered species stories, for example, you've got to be kidding me. And these are nationally syndicated radio show hosts that are saying that can't be so. So I explain to them and I show them exactly what has transpired on some of these stories, and it's frightening. And you know, the message is getting out there, and these are real life stories that are in this book. There's 10 stories in each one of these sections, but they're real life stories. They're researched. They're just not news articles that I pasted together. I talked with many of these people. I actually went into court documents to verify certain facts. So these are real stories, and they're just not cherry-picked stories. I have stories on my website, governmentpirates.com, of people sending me. There's a feature on there that says, tell us your story. I'm getting some stories on that are just as egregious, if not more so, than what I have in the book. So it's enlightened a lot of people, and a lot of people are just outraged by this.
We're talking to Don Corris. He's the author of Government Pirates, The Assault on Private Property Rights and How We Can Fight It. It's an excellent book. I've read every single word of it, and I would highly recommend that you read it if you want to know where your private property rights are going. Don, I have to tell you, first of all, I meant to tell you at the top of the hour that I've had a number of people write in and call me and ask me to please invite Don Corris on to talk about it because they heard you on other shows. So there's a lot of interest. You've done something. You've ignited something. You've got people interested. But I have to tell you, my favorite Endangered Species Act abuse story is the guy from Utah, the RV campground.
The snail.
The snail. I mean, talk about stupid government.
Yeah.
You want to tell us that story?
Yeah, it was a developer in Utah. A gentleman that was had a piece of property that he was going to develop an RV campground on, and a small golf course. I believe it was an executive golf course, a par three. And he was halted from building anything as a result of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They came out and an emergency listed a 1-inch snail, and this snail was the only place that it was located in the country, apparently, was this specific location. A biologist came down from Indiana who had said that this was probably the most amazing discovery that she's seen in her biological career. And essentially what happened was that this guy was threatened with a fine for $50,000 for each snail that would have been eaten by a flock of geese that sort of mysteriously showed up on this guy's property one day. Now, I'm not suggesting that he got this flock of geese, but that's certainly one way to get rid of snails. This particular snail, as I said, was not in any other location in the country. And today, this guy still has not developed his RV campground because the snails are being protected.
What I thought was totally ridiculous was that the government sent some people down to shoot the geese.
Yeah.
And they were supposed to send them the contents of the geese's stomachs so that they could decide how many of these precious snails had been eaten, so they could actually fine him 50,000. Because when I was reading your book, it said he was going to be fined 50,000 for every snail that was eaten. I'm going, how on earth are they going to figure that out? But you provided the answer as the story went along. They were, you know, they're going to protect the 1-inch snail, but they're going to shoot 11 geese.
Yeah, well, they never ended up shooting the geese because this guy was savvy enough to get the media involved. And even the laziest journalist would find this story sort of interesting. So all these photographers and journalists came out to the site and were perched there watching and waiting for the state wildlife agency to come out and plug these geese. And, of course, when he saw that, he didn't do a thing. There's a quote in the book by this biologist from Indiana University, and said that she said that she was so delighted with the snail find, and quote, it was really unexpected. She said it gives us another population in a new location. That's always a good thing. Unfortunately, the owner didn't think that way. So reportedly, it cost him $2.5 million, and
for having these snails on his property.
Exactly, he wasn't able to develop his property, and he alleged that his damages were $2.5 million.
Good heavens!
Yeah. that's one of the more mild stories. How about the one? How about the fly? Did you like that one?
I loved all of them. Actually, go ahead, tell us about. I like the grizzly bear. I mean, I loved all of them.
Yeah, well, the fly story seems to be a lot of people's favorite. And there was in Colton, the city of Colton, California, in Southern California, was in dire straits economically. And they were chosen as a site for a $500 million regional medical center. And it was a great thing to happen for this community. And they went ahead and had their project approved. All the plans were drawn up. And just a few days before they were supposed to break ground, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service emergency listed a fly. And it's the proper name of the fly is the Delphi sands flower-loving fly. And this is the only location on Earth that this fly is located. And essentially what they did is they halted the project, they said that more studies were necessary, and they put this project, the contractor and the architect, and I spoke to the architect personally on this to verify these facts, because at first I didn't believe it. So they put them through the ringer for almost 2 years. I think it was 22 months. And it took them 22 months to redesign the project. And during that time, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, some official, demanded that Interstate 10, as we all know, is an interstate cross-country highway, be shut down or traffic being diverted from that during the months of August and September, because that was the supposed breeding season for the fly. They didn't want the flies to end up on anybody's windshield. So they had the gall to do that. And essentially what happened was that the project was delayed for so long that it contributed a cost increase to the project of $25 million for a few colonies of flies. A fly, by the way, that they didn't even know what the lifespan is. The biologist who wrote the report said that it's between 2 days and 2 weeks. He actually said that before a congressional committee.
I know, it's so ridiculous.
I mean, it's just unbelievable.
I guess we're going to be afraid of swatting flies now, right? Shooing a fly off your plate if you happen to be eating outdoors someplace.
Yeah, and I was on Hannity and Combs on Fox News Channel, and I was debating this with Alan Combs. And Alan Combs said, well, don't you think that all life should be protected? I said, Alan, it's a fly. And he says, well, it looks like a Republican to me. And I was so tempted to say, Alan, this fly looks like you. But I didn't do it. I should have, though.
But what about all, you know, if you're going to follow his line of reasoning, why would you kill 11 geese?
Yeah, exactly.
To go ahead and figure out how much to fine this guy, because that's the only reason they're doing it.
I guess the thing I would challenge biologists and environmentalists on the fly story would be is that how important is this fly to the ecosystem? I mean, are other species going to die off? And I guess the answer is always, well, we don't know. We really don't know. There are plants that that depend on this fly for pollinization, maybe. There are other insects that eat the fly. There could be animals that eat the fly.
And who's going to get fined if those animals eat the flies?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it's just, that's probably one of the most outrageous and ludicrous stories in the book. But then there's stories about cave bugs, the story that you mentioned about the rancher who endured an 8-year legal battle because a judge, he killed a grizzly bear, which at the time was a threatened species, in self-defense, and it was self-defense, and he was fined and endured an 8-year legal battle because a judge said he and his dog provoked the attacking bear.
This was in the middle of the night when he heard his lamb's cry. I know.
Yeah. That they provoked it.
But since you mentioned judges, another one of our favorite topics around the world today is what are these judges doing? They seem to be waking up and taking an overdose of stupid pills.
Yeah, you know, you would think that the federal judges, and particularly the Supreme Court judges, would adhere, at least try to adhere, to the text of the Constitution. For example, in the Fifth Amendment, there's 12 simple words, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. And that applies to eminent domain, zoning, wetlands, and endangered species protection, as well as any other takings that are out there. And, you know, if I've debated this issue with several environmentalists, and quite frankly, and I'm not tooting my own horn, but I always come out on the winning end. Either they hang up on me, which one radio host hung up on me one time.
You're kidding.
No, Tom Hartman, who's with Air America, and he's the same person that recently just said that Sarah Palin's son, he basically went on the air and said that his disadvantaged son that was born was actually his Sarah Palin's daughter's son. And that's how kooky this guy is.
Yeah, I can't do the math. She's 5 months pregnant. The baby is 5 months.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
Those are just numbers. Those aren't the facts. don't let the facts get in the way of a good story. But I've debated with people like him of saying that, let's take, for example, an endangered species. If in fact this fly or these snails, for example, if these are important, I get them to understand that it's important for the public, and they understand that yes, it is important for a public, and I get them more often than not to say then it's for a public purpose, and they say yes, it's for a public purpose to have our generations, future generations, enjoy these plants and animal species.
These flies.
But then I say, if it's for a public purpose, and many of them, frankly, agree with me on the Kelo decision that was disastrous. But then when you compare the fly story and the snail story, and you say, well, if you say Kelo is for a public, that was for a public purpose, that was not for a public purpose, and you're saying that the government should that was a disastrous decision, then if it's for a public purpose for a fly, why then doesn't the government pay that property owner to preserve those flies? Oh no, that's different. This is an animal. We need to protect it. You know, this is an insect. This is a snail. This is important to the ecosystem. So it doesn't make any sense. They just don't make any sense when they try to come up with an argument of saying that if you have one of these species or you have a wetlands on your property, that the government should compensate you if you can't use that property. But that's where their whole argument fails.
You know, my question would be, so much land in this country and around the world has been turned into preservations where nobody can go. How do we know what kind of animals live there and whether or not some of these species are in fact only located in these tiny little, 12 square inch locations?
Yeah, I mean, the way the Endangered Species Act works, and of course, clearly, the Endangered Species Act trumps the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. It's very clear that it does that because with endangered species regulation, the government doesn't have to compensate you. In fact, they extort land and property from you in return for approvals. And so the Endangered Species Act is set up in a way where supposedly biologists do studies on a certain species. And these biologists could be university biologists. They could be someone, they could be a kid in high school that does a study. And the government has to recognize these, and of course they look into them supposedly. But if it's a biologist of some renown or a biologist that the government respects, those studies are taken into account for each one of these listings. And in many cases, for example, the fly story, it was one biologist that came up with a report that this fly existed and that it was endangered. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service took that into account. And in fact, this biologist, during a congressional hearing, was asked, you know, have you ever seen a fly? And the guy says, yes. And then the congressman, it was Congressman Pombo, I believe, said, have you ever seen one alive? And the guy says, no, I've never seen one alive. So they base their studies in some cases on junk science, and it's skewed in favor of protecting the species. Now, you have the opportunity to refute those studies, but by and large, you're not talking to the choir, because many of the people in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, particularly the staff people, they are they're environmentalists and they want to shut things down, and so it's a law that's broken and it needs to be fixed. Unfortunately, we don't have enough political backbone to do it, and when you do try to make a change to the Endangered Species Act, you'll find the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society and some of these other environmental groups that'll start talking about the poor polar bears, and they'll talk about all kinds of things of making sure that this plant or animal species can exist for future generations. But you have to understand, I'm not saying that some of these environmental protections aren't necessary. They are. We have an environmental ethic today, which I think in many cases is beneficial. The problem is that the environmentalist per se is becoming someone who is an extremist, who's anti-capitalistic, and they don't believe that there's a balance. I personally consider myself a conservationist, and I believe that we should conserve our natural heritage, our water resources. I think we should do everything we can to make sure species don't go extinct. However, there has to be some common sense on this. When you have a fly that stops a project that increases the cost of that project by $25 million, you know something has gone wrong. And but there are ways to manage growth and to make allocations to conserve our resources. Unfortunately, you just have people in the environmental community who are on sort of a what I call an environmental jihad. This is their life's work, and they are trying to do everything they can to stop the capitalistic system.
You had mentioned someplace, in fact, that was going to be my next question. You had mentioned that you were a conservationist, not an environmentalist. And I guess that's what you mean. You want to conserve nature, but not necessarily, you know, go to the extremes that a lot of these extreme organizations go to.
Well, exactly. I mean, I've done several developments over the years where we have set aside on our own open space area that wasn't in some instances wasn't required by the state or the local state or federal officials. We set aside open space area because it's an amenity to the project, and it actually creates value. So a lot of people don't realize that there is development, large-scale developments that do that. Now, you also have developers that will, and I'm not saying you don't have developers that try to rape the land and get every unit or every bit of square footage on a piece of property. That happens. There's no question of that. But there is a creative way, as long as people think out of the box, a creative way to satisfy some of these environmental protections and still have economic development. There is no economic or industrial activity on Earth that does not degrade the environment to a certain degree. It's just as how much are we willing to affect the environment for a certain economic activity. People still have to have jobs. They still have to be able to put food on people's on their families' tables. Corporations need to be making a profit. So, it shouldn't be emotional like it is now. It should be based upon good, sound economics. But the environmentalists, apparently many of them don't even know what economics is, because it's always let's protect this, let's protect that, and who cares if it affects somebody's private property rights. What they don't see, what I have seen throughout the country, as I've looked into people's eyes, I've sat in their kitchen tables, and I've heard their stories, and they have told me of how their lives have been ravaged and ruined by environmental regulations, how they've lost their home or how they weren't able to put their kids through college and that sort of thing. There's a real real consequence to these things, which the environmentalists don't seem to really understand, and in some cases, some of them don't even care.
It's funny, funny that you mentioned the look of the people, you know, looking in people's eyes. I saw about a 10-15 minute clip of a documentary that unfortunately was never finished. And this had to do with people and how they were affected by all of these government regulations and the takings. There were about 300 people in the room. There wasn't a dry eye in the room when that clip was over with. And for whatever reason, that project was never completed. That had the makings, I thought, of being an extremely powerful documentary. I'd heard, whether there's any truth to it or not, I don't know, that a lot of the homeowners had withdrawn permission to have their pictures and stories told for fear of retribution.
Yep. That happens a lot. In fact, as I interviewed people throughout the country, or at least tried to, there were several people, one woman in particular in California, who I won't name, but it was a fairly famous case. She told me that, first of all, she said that I don't want to talk to any journalist. I try to explain to her that I'm not a journalist, but she said, every time I tell my story, it's always done wrong. Mm-hmm. So it always gets butchered. But she said, and then I was able to quell her fears a little bit and tell her who I was. And she said, well, you know, I think you're well-intended, but the problem is that I have another piece of property that I'm trying to get a couple home sites approved for, because that's my retirement. And if I talk to you and that story comes out from years past, I know that they're gonna deny me my permit so that I can build those homes. She said, so I can't talk to you because there's gonna be retribution. She said, I don't want to spend another $200,000 in legal fees because that was my life savings. So you have a lot of that going on. You had mentioned before we got on the line of a county supervisor in your area.
A couple of them, yeah.
Yeah, who. Why don't you repeat that story again?
Well, the story was in the Washington Post yesterday,
yeah.
I think, and it has to do with the Madera School. The Madera School is a private school that's been around in the area for a long, long time, and they own some prime property that borders on part of the Potomac. Jerry Conley, who's the chairman of the board, I guess made advances and said he wanted to build a path, a walking path right along the Potomac, and wanted an easement through their property. The school said no, that would open it up and would endanger their kids. I mean, it's a girls' school, so they didn't really want strangers to have access to the property. The representative from that area made the comment, John Faust, said, that's okay because these people have got a request in to do some, they're going to upgrade the sewer system and make some modifications or upgrade some of the property, some of the buildings on the property. He says, we'll hold those up and we'll get what we want. The fact is that the school had already apparently given them an easement along a main road, so they could connect the two pathways. There was no reason not to do that. They've had that easement for years, and they've never used it. I mean, it's going back to what we were talking about earlier, where the government takes these things just for the sake of taking it, it seems, and they never use it. But that I'll try to do a show on that one as well, because I think that's
well. In that particular case, I'm assuming that this was done at a public hearing. And if it was done at a public hearing, in most cases, those public hearings are videotaped.
Right.
And it would be interesting to have that videotape being played, either to people to link onto it on your website, and to see these statements that are made by this person, because I know that that's been used very effectively throughout the country, of people. You know, these politicians acting badly. And once they see themselves on video, and once they see that that video is being broadcasted throughout the country, you know, they tend to straighten up a little bit.
Well, with some of these, I don't know.
Well, they probably figure, well, you know, it'll go over in a couple weeks.
The scary part, Don, is that they think they're doing the right thing. They think that by forcing the issue, they actually claimed that the fear that the kids would be exposed to everybody who would want to walk on this public walkway was fear-mongering.
Yeah, well, they're doing it for the greater good.
It's
always the greater good. And unfortunately, a lot of these people who attain these elected positions, especially in local government. Many of these people I have found, and I've developed property from Texas to Southern California to Florida, where I now currently reside, and I find that many of these people in city council are people who weren't very successful or who are not successful in their own right, in their own profession. So this is an opportunity for these type of people to be able to exercise power. And when they get into the, when they look across and they see somebody that's making more money than them, particularly a developer, and they look at this guy and say, well, you know, I don't like this guy because he's made more money than me or he's more successful. I'm not saying that's for all people, but I've run into these cases in numerous places throughout the country where the bottom line is it's wealth envy. So they figure, let's extract something from this developer or this homeowner that is a well-to-do homeowner or even not a well-to-do homeowner. Let's extract something from them because we can and because it's for the greater good. But behind the scenes, they're really thinking, boy, I really put the screws on that guy. And there's a lot of people like that in elected office throughout the country. I mean, that's why I always say, local politics is like a cesspool.
You're right. Maybe you can answer a question that I've always had and have never found the answer to, and that is when these local politicians get into power, the salaries that they get are not really that great, but all of a sudden they seem to be moving up into multi-million dollar houses. They seem to be flush with a lot of money. Where does it come from, Don?
Yeah.
How do they do it?
Yeah, I haven't really been exposed to situations like that as much. I'm sure that that's going on.
Oh, a lot.
I'm sure they're able to. Some politicians are just simply corrupt, and they'll take bribes. I really haven't run into that too much. But I also believe that the politician is corrupt if they do the things that I've just been saying about trying to extract things from people, exact property and money from people in return for approvals, like that example at Fairfax, that supervisor that you had mentioned. I mean, there's a guy that needs to be taken to task, and there's a guy as a good example that if enough people get mad in that community and they join forces and they make that video available, they go ahead and write letters of complaint, and then if there's enough people that really care about that issue, you vote that bum out of office. That's exactly what you need to do. Exactly. Get him out of office.
Yeah.
Use your vote. Use that as a weapon.
You're right.
And programs like yours, you're very conversant in property rights. You know, you need to get the message out to people, and people need to be able to engage you to tell you these things. And when you can do that, you can really be a force to be reckoned with, because quite frankly, a lot of people, you really can't count on the legal system to defend your rights.
No, you can't.
It's like a minefield. So it's like stepping into a minefield if you're trying to go ahead and refute and challenge some of these regulations.
I do get a lot of calls and a lot of emails from people who desperately need help. It's kind of scary, and that's why I do the show. It's to get the information out there. Information that they're probably not going to get too many other places. In your case, yes, but you've got your book out and you're getting a lot of publicity, and I'm really thrilled about that because it's desperately needed.
Yeah, and as I said, this has really become, the property rights is starting to become one of these kitchen table issues that we talk about so much, and it's something that's important, because what's more important than someone's home? I mean, it's sentimental value. It serves as a symbol as of our fruits of our labor. People use the equity in their home to start businesses. People use the equity in their home to retire from. I was given a figure about 90% of people throughout America use the equity in their home at least for some portion of their retirement. You know, what's more important than your home or your ranch or your farm? And it's just a sad commentary to see how our government, particularly these judges, how they just disregard property rights.
There was an outcry after the Kelo decision that kind of got a lot of states involved in at least trying or looking like they were going to try to, reinforce property rights in the states. But a lot of them waffled, and a lot of the stuff got watered down. Once the outcry died down, like it would, because, you know, nobody's going to sustain that at any great level. How do we keep the pressure up?
Well, that's a good question. And you have to have a compliant media, which you're not going to get in the mainstream media. I can guarantee you that.
Oh, I know.
So what needs to be done is that people, just like in that case for that Fairfax County supervisor, people need to get involved and they need to voice their opinion. And if there's enough people doing this through different parts of the country, these politicians are going to understand things. I have a unique opportunity to speak in front of about 150 state legislators in a couple months who are newly elected state, or some of whom will be newly elected state legislators, who want to learn more about property rights. That's an opportunity to show these people exactly what's going on in the local communities and what states need to do to protect people's property rights. Those are the sort of things when you get politicians to say, you know, this just isn't right. But they need to be educated. And the book hopefully is doing that to people. I know my book's been given to all of the state legislators in the state of New York by a group up there. The book serves as a wake-up call, and I'm not saying that mine is the only book out there. There are several good books written on private property rights. Unfortunately, all of them, you know, they're speaking to the choir. They're not books that are designed for everyday Americans to be able to read and to absorb the material. And that's one of the reasons why they're so heavy on some of these stories, because the stories give you a picture of actually what's going on. These aren't some abstract theories. These aren't some talking points, some rhetoric that you would hear from politicians. These are real-life stories, real-life Americans, in some cases your own neighbors that are going through these torturous incidences.
I go out and talk to, and I hear from people, quite often people will come to me and they'll say, oh, shoot. You don't mean all homeowner associations. You don't mean all government regulations. You don't mean all of this. You mean some, right? And I go, no, I mean all. And the thing is that unless it's happening to them, it just doesn't seem to sink in. I mean, I've had people say, well, no, that we don't foreclose. We don't fine and foreclose. It just doesn't happen. It's not in my association. I go, what is your association? And if it's a local one, I know it. And they go, but you've been in the papers. you've had stories written about you. And they go, yeah, I know, but you don't understand. We don't do that. And I go, but I've heard from some of your neighbors. You do that. Yeah, I know my neighbors had problems, but you don't understand, Sue. We don't have those problems. Translated, once you sort of peel all the layers of the onion and you get down to the nitty-gritty, it's, I haven't had any problems, so it doesn't exist.
Exactly. And for every story that's in my book, I can guarantee you, and many of the people I spoke to personally, I can guarantee you, one of the parts of the conversation I had with them, I kept on asking them, do you think that this would have ever happened to you? And they said, I had no idea that anything like this would happen. I've heard about it. I've heard that you could do this, the government could do it, but I never imagined that it would happen to me. But guess what? This can happen to anybody. And even if it doesn't happen to somebody, what happened to the Christian values of standing up for your neighbors that it is happening to? You know, it's just plain wrong. You know, it just gets down to the point of government abuse. And yes, we're all busy, you know, worrying about energy prices, who we're going to vote for, how we're going to put food on our table, worried about paying our mortgage and so forth. Those are all legitimate concerns, and it take up the majority of our daily lives. But we also have to think about what could happen. And it's not a scare tactic, it's reality. And you only have to pick up this book and read some of the stories of how these realities are just shattering people's lives.
The book is Government Pirates, The Assault on Private Property Rights and How We Can Fight It by Don Kors. You also have a website, Don?
Yes, the website is governmentpirates.com. There are some links and resources on that website that I would encourage people to look at. There are think tanks who specialize in property rights. Also, some legal foundations who, if it's the right case, will be able to actually provide legal assistance for people. Obviously, there's so many of these cases, they can't do it for everybody. There's also a feature on the site called Tell Us Your Stories, and I have been flooded with, I think I'm up to about 600 or 700 stories right now of people throughout the country who have told me their story, and I've read them. In some cases, I was able to get back with them, but obviously for that many, I can't physically do it. But, you know, tell us your story, because during my book tour and even after it, I'm going back on nationally syndicated radio shows like yours, TV shows, and I'm going to be exposing some of the other stories that aren't in my book at some point. So some of these stories may find their way on TV or on talk radio.
What would you say to people who are afraid of having their stories told?
Well, that's a very difficult sort of situation that these people are in. Obviously, if they're going to be, if they know that they're going to be picked upon by the government, let's just say, and if it's your very livelihood that's stake, obviously there isn't much you can do. You're going to have to acquiesce, especially if you don't have the money, the resources to fight it. So for those people, it's sort of a personal decision. And, you know, in some cases it's better to let a sleeping dog lie. But then there are other cases where the government has gotten so abusive, some people throw up their hands and says, well, what can they do? They've already taken this, or, you know, my life is already ruined. What can they possibly do to me? And they need to think of things like that, too. And there isn't a lot of help out there for people. So that's why you have to sort of build coalitions for other like-minded people who are being affected. And and then engage the media. Get on programs like yours. Be able to have access to media, whether it's talk radio, TV, or whether it's, you know, write an op-ed in the newspaper and that sort of thing.
Well, one of the things I tell people is you really can't fight this in the dark. And I think it goes back to one of my favorite stories in your book, and that's the snails.
Yeah.
You know, those geese would have been history.
Yep.
If the press hadn't come. I mean, if there was no... Because people aren't going to do in public what they do privately, and the bullies kind of like it when you're under cover of darkness.
Yep.
And that's what they are, Don. Let's face it. They're government bullies. They're the little guys who, as you said earlier, have never made anything of their lives, and all of a sudden they find themselves in the government, and they think they've got all this power, and they think they can just abuse people.
Yeah, for their own personal inadequacies, they foist regulations, and they use leverage, the government leverage, to create situations for people that are just unfathomable and that should never happen.
I very quickly, you know, earlier you were talking about when you develop, you develop open space, and it creates, and people don't realize that it creates value. How does that square with the current trend of tearing everything down and building in the new urbanist tradition? How are you finding it hard to do that?
Well, in the urbanist tradition, exactly what do you mean by that?
The new urbanism, where they're tearing down the suburbs and replacing them with all these high rises, no front lawns, no backyards, little alleys. You know, we don't want cars. We don't want anything, basically.
Yeah. Well, they say that it reduces urban sprawl. And there is something to be said for more dense development, and then to leave more more land in open space. Some of this is being done in areas here in Florida, for example, where high density residential will be approved, but it's within a master plan development. As far as high rise development, I build high rise condos, for example, in Florida. In high-rise condos, there's actually less impact if you can do what we call needles in the sky. There's less spread out. There's less view corridors that are impacted, and in some cases, there's less impact to the environment, and you can provide this open space. It's a hard question to answer as far as how a community should react to this, because every community is different. It has different character, has different environmental issues. But there is something to be said for more dense development that can be surrounded, for example, by more open space. Or there is something to be said for high-rise development if it's quite frankly, if it's marketable. So, but again, all real estate is local. And it has to be, each one of these are separate and distinct cases. And what's good for one community in Fairfax is probably not good for a community down here in Florida, for example.
Well, right after I read your story about Sunny Isles, Florida, I'd never heard of the place. Within hours, literally, I heard from, I got an email from someone who was just absolutely devastated because she was having problems, and I never did quite understand what it was, whether it was a taking or whether it was with her homeowners association board, but it was happening in Sunny Isles, Florida. I called her and she said, well, she says, Trump has built these towers. And I said, yeah, I just read about them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know. It's,
well, my book doesn't get into homeowners associations,
no.
But my next book is.
Really?
I started to do an outline for the second book. My publisher is pushing me a little bit. And one of the things that I'll be examining is homeowners associations, which I have intimate knowledge with as a condo developer, believe me. And I've dealt with condo commandos and some of these other issues, particularly here in Florida. But I would encourage people that listen to your podcast to go onto my website and tell us the stories, these condominium association stories, these homeowners association stories, because I know that there's a wealth of information. In some cases, there are stories that are so ludicrous they're amusing, and there are people that do things in homeowners associations. Once they get together, it's sad. It's almost like a tragic comedy.
We need to talk, Don. But we're out of time today. We need to talk because I've got lots of information for you.
Okay.
Thank you so very much for joining us today, Don. I really appreciate it. I know you've got an appointment to go to. The hour's flown by, and I hope you'll come back.
Well, I'll be glad to. And let's stay in touch. And like I just said, on these homeowners association stories, let me know about them.
I got tons for you.
They may find themselves in the next book.
Sounds like a plan.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Don.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.